good to be here this morning. I feel like I'm among friends. I recognize a number of you, and so it's good to be back here again, and I do appreciate that. Now, I have a lot of information to cover and a little bit of time to cover it, so the average speaking speed is about 130 words per minute. I'm going to clip right along at 150 with gusts up to 250. So please listen fast, and we'll go ahead and get through of this. You know, Chaz is absolutely right. Chaz, I appreciate that introduction. I am a zoologist, okay, so I study zoos, that's it. And I called the San Diego Zoo last week, but the lion was busy. Thank you. Chaz, do you like that? Lion was busy. And so I'm a zoologist, and so my degree is in zoology, which is a study of animals, but you'd be here all the morning, you'd never guess what animals I study, and that is parasites. I'm a parasitologist. And so I even used to teach it to my pre-med students and students going on to the field of missions. And so I'm a parasitologist. You don't have to go to France to study parasites. Thank you. I'll be here all morning. And so I'll have to go ahead and get into this very quickly. Before I do, I want to introduce my lovely wife, Jan. Jan, if you would wave. Jan and I have been married about 36 years, and we've been blessed with four children, three girls and a tag-along boy named Roy. He's a real joy. But Roy just graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering from Baylor, and he's going to be working up north of Detroit, working at Fiat Chrysler. And so, as we say in Texas, I'm grinning like a butcher's dog. Maybe you've never heard that before. Many things that we say in Texas, a lot of people have a big question mark over their head. So, Chaz is absolutely correct. Science and the Bible go together beautifully. Science and the Bible, just like butter and bread. Science and the Bible go together. They dovetail together just like politics and corruption. They go inextricably linked. And so we're going to see that now. As an undergraduate at Western State College in Gunnison, Colorado, that was my undergraduate degree in biology. I was taught nothing but evolutionary naturalism, that I came from a fish. Then after about 4.5 years on a city fire department in Greeley, and that's where I met my wife at a Christian fellowship, I went to the University of Northern Colorado, got my degree in zoology, again taught nothing but evolution. The only time creation was mentioned was in a very negative way. They denigrated creationists and Christians in general. So nobody can say that I've been in some kind of fundamentalist hothouse all of those years. And I went to Billy Bob's Backwater Bayou Bible College and School of Electric Fan Repair. Nothing like that. I was spoon-fed the theory of evolution. But here I am this morning sharing with you about the wonders and the mysteries of God's living creation. And certainly the psalmist is true when he said in Psalm 19:1 that the heavens declare the glory of God. Certainly that's true. And we saw that just recently, didn't we, with the eclipse. And so although that's kind of boring, that's nothing like parasitology, it does reveal God's glory. So let's go ahead and look at this. Chaz mentioned our Discovery Center. We're very excited about that. And so please come and see us this time next year. You'll be up and running, and we're really going to have a lot of fun with that, as this Discovery Center will give glory to the Creator and not the creation. That's what the Apostle Paul talks about in Romans chapter 1, giving glory to the Creator and not the creation. Of course, the secular world has that exactly the opposite, don't they? It's just like Grand Canyon. Grand Canyon was formed by a whole lot of water over a short period of time. What does the world do? They turn it around. Talk about Grand Canyon being formed, carved sand grain by the little Colorado River over millions and millions. You have to do this with your hands. Millions and millions of years. And so that's so true when it comes to God's word and man's naturalistic attempt to explain the world around us. This is a verse that Jan and I taught our children throughout the years. Here the Apostle Peter is telling his readers to have an apologia. An apologia, what is that? An apologia is an apologetic, knowing why you believe, what you believe, not only when it comes to your origin, where you came from, and what we like to say at ICR is where you came from is at least as important as to where you're going. Peter is saying, have this apologia, have this apologetic, know why you believe, what you believe. Most of us here this morning, I wouldn't hesitate to say, are probably creationists. Yes, I believe, Frank, that in the beginning God created. That's wonderful. That's commendable. Now, why do you believe what you believe? Having this apologia, as Peter talks about, Christian students need to identify where science leaves off and secular philosophy begins. Oh boy, is there a lot of secular philosophy out there. And what we need to do is have this spirit of discernment, knowing why you believe what you believe, being very cognizant of where secular philosophy leaves off and real empirical evidences, that is, science, begins. If somebody were to say to you, that's not empirical, what they mean is you cannot observe, test, or repeat it. Let me give you a quick example, real quick. This is a supernova that you see here. Evolutionists tell us with a straight face, this supernova, it's a star that got incredibly compacted and then blew up, spreading out material throughout the universe over the millions and millions of years. And so this is an artist rendition of a supernova, a star that blew up, sending out all its material, which includes the element iron. We've all heard of the element iron, and the element iron is found in our blood. You've heard of hemoglobin, right? Hemoglobin carries oxygen. But the only way that hemoglobin can carry oxygen is with a critical iron atom associated with it. We call it the heme group. I won't get into that any more than that this morning, but it's very important. Now, the evolutionists do a very unscientific step, a philosophical step, if you will. And they say that the iron in your blood came from that supernova in unknown reaches of space billions of years ago. Is that scientific? No, it's not. It's not scientific at all. That happened in an unknown area of space billions of years ago. In other words, it was unobserved. It was unobserved in an area of space that we don't know of in an unknown period of time ago. And yet we're supposed to believe that the iron in our blood right now came from that supernova. That's philosophy. That's not science. Now, I don't want to denigrate the Perot Museum, but that's what they have in their display. They say the iron in your blood came from a supernova, and you have to understand that's a philosophical statement. That's not science. Speaking of philosophical statements, there's a lot of philosophical statements in this infamous book published in the year 1859. This book by Charles Darwin turned the Western world upside down and is still taught as fact today, talking about unscientific ideas that you and I came from a fish. As we say in Texas, I'm agin it. Okay, I'm against it. I'm against using my hard-earned tax dollars to teach the next generation that they came from lower life forms where there's absolutely no scientific evidence for it. Now remember, I've had a lot of evolution as an undergraduate and as a graduate student in zoology. As a matter of fact, one of the courses my late professor told me I had to take was a course entitled Evolution, and it was a graduate-level course. But if the evidence isn't there, it's not there. It doesn't matter how many courses you've had in evolution. And one thing I learned was there is no evidence for evolution. We talked a lot about genetics in my class. This class I had to take, but not much else. Here we find this book talking about a lot of philosophical presuppositions, but not real dyed-in-the-wool, USDA-inspected science. So here's something about the most sophisticated entity in the universe. It's called the 3-pound human brain, the most detailed, sophisticated accumulation of matter in the known universe. Will we ever understand the function of the brain? We never will. We never will. It's simply too complex. It is enormously complex, and we'll never understand it. Look at the quote up there. The Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago, and the Moon formed about 30 million years later. There is no way, ladies and gentlemen, that we can document this empirically. That happened in the unknown past, didn't it? Shake your head like this. Yeah, formation of the Earth, according to evolution, formation of the Moon, according to evolution, happened in the unobserved past. It was a one-time event. Nobody was there to take notes and observe it. But look what it says here, the last sentence, and this is one thing I want to park on, and yes, I'm going to go along very quickly. At that time, the Earth was a magma ocean. What is magma, class? Lava. Very good, lava. Magma, lava, it's pretty much the same thing, okay? And so here, this author of this secular publication back in 2014, very recent, said that this earth long, long ago was a magma ocean. Well, this magma ocean, red hot rock, that was sterile. Sterile means no microorganisms, no life whatsoever. It was sterile. So they're saying with authority that this is what the planet was like in the unobserved past. Nobody was there to take notes. And it was a sterile magma ocean. Now get that, because the evolutionists say this magma ocean, and here's a good picture of it. This is magma, this is lava. They say through time, this magma ocean, billions of years ago, gave rise to the 3-pound human brain, the most sophisticated accumulation of matter in the known universe. Is that scientific? No. Again, please understand, students, you have to have the spirit of discernment. You must be able to discern where science leaves off and philosophy begins. This is steeped in philosophical naturalism. Remember, ask the critical questions. Was anybody there to observe it, to take notes, to see what happened? And quite honestly, yeah, again, ICR is not designed to make fun of anybody or point fingers, but this really is silly. It really is silly. A red-hot magma ocean that's sterile, giving rise to the 3-pound human brain, no creator, no designer, just time and chance, and they expect us to believe that? How much more scientific, if you will, is the theory of evolution, the creation model? What does the word Genesis mean? Anybody? It's just us here this morning. Very good. Beginnings. The word Genesis means beginnings. Beginnings. And so that's what the book of Genesis is about, the book of beginnings. Remember I mentioned earlier where you came from is at least as important as where you're going. And so the book of Genesis tells about our origin. It was written by somebody who was there when? In the beginning. Genesis was written by somebody who was there in the beginning. He, if you will, took notes and let us know in the 21st century what happened in the beginning just thousands of years ago. All the author wants us to understand is to read it and to believe it and to tell others about it. Isn't that neat? One of the most scientific statements I've ever read as a zoologist is Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Think about that. Evolutionists and creationists both agree that this universe is composed of time and space and matter. And when you read the first verse of the first chapter of the first book of the book of books, God is telling us in the beginning, time, God created the heavens, space, and the earth, matter. So here we find in the first verse of Genesis, God, who has always existed, speaking into existence, time, space, and matter. And I would submit to you this morning very quickly that there's no other religious writing on this planet that begins like the infallible, inerrant Word of God, written by somebody who was there in the beginning. So Genesis is the true origins account. Some people think Genesis is just a story, a fairy tale, but all 50 chapters are written in the historical narrative Hebrew. In the historical narrative Hebrew. God wants us to understand that He is speaking literally from the very first verse. We don't have to try and make excuses for Genesis 1 through 11, talk about some kind of poetical interpretation. No, God has written all 50 chapters in this narrative Hebrew for us to understand. Remember what Paul said in Corinthians? God is not the author of confusion. God is not the author of confusion. Why? He loves us too much. He wants us to understand about our origin. He wants us to understand about our purpose in life. He wants us to understand about our destiny, where we're going when we die. So God is not the author of confusion, especially, students, especially in this critical issue of origin. So here's a question in the morning. Is it really possible to talk honestly and fairly about scientific evidence for creation? As a scientist, of course, I say yes, it is. It's very honest and very fair to look at the hard questions about our origin and make some conclusions about that. There is scientific evidence for creation. God has given us tools of inquiry, you know that? So if you're taking notes, and I see some of you are, God has blessed us, He has given us tools of investigation, of inquiry, of research. These are tools, students, listen, that you and I use every single day of our lives. The first tool of inquiry God has blessed us with is logic. That 3-pound brain I talked about earlier is an organ of logic. Logic. Understanding the world around us. And the second thing that God has given us is observation. Observation. Logic and observation, hey, that's something you and I have done already this morning. So as we have been blessed with logic and observation, we can come to conclusions about the world around us because God is not the author of confusion. He wants us to think His thoughts after Him. Isn't that neat? That's why I find one of the most satisfying things I can do as a zoologist is study God's living creation, even though it's been corrupted by sin, hasn't it? And if you wanted to talk about corruption of the creation, just talk to me a few minutes about parasites. I can give you parasite life cycles that will curl your hair. But you know what we're finding out? We're finding out in this 21st century, there are some parasites that are neutral. In other words, they're not beneficial, but they're not pathogenic either, disease-causing. They seem to be neutral. In some cases, some parasites seem to be beneficial under certain conditions, which is an indication of maybe the function of parasites before the fall, but that's a whole different presentation. So what are the two tools that God has given us? Help me out, it's just us here. Logic, very good. Observation, using the peepers, observation. So using logic and observation, when we look at Mount Rushmore, we do not say, wow, look what time and chance and weathering and erosion have done to the side of that mountain. That looks like 2-4 faces. No, we don't come to that conclusion, do we? No, looking, using logic and observation, as the sun rises and we see Mount Rushmore, that we didn't see the creator of Mount Rushmore, did we? No, that happened in the 1930s. We didn't see the creator of Mount Rushmore. Did we see the creative act? No, we didn't see the creative act either. That was in the unobserved past, right? Just like creation was in the unobserved past. But the evidence is right there for all to see. Somebody had to have made that. Can we agree with that this morning? Somebody had to have made that. It wouldn't make itself. I don't care how much weathering and erosion has occurred, it's not going to form something like Mount Rushmore. This brings us to what the Apostle Paul said. Now, that's my introduction. Here's a main body. Romans chapter 1 in verse 20. The Apostle Paul is saying that God's creation is, as you can see in the quote there, not only seen, but Paul adds a word, clearly seen. Let's say that those two words together. Clearly seen. That was terrible. Let's try it again. Clearly seen. Very good. Clearly seen. Now, the Sherwin translation of that clearly seen is painfully obvious. Painfully. In other words, you would be tripping over evidence for creation, and you have to get up and brush yourself off and walk off like you never saw it. Because why? God loves us. He loves us so much that He has made His creation not only seen, but clearly seen. Even though it's been corrupted by sin, the evidence is still there for all to see. And then he ends the verse with the warning, doesn't he? Look at the warning Paul gave the reader, not ICR, not Chaz or me, the Apostle Paul in Romans 1. He said, so that they are without what class? So that they're without excuse. So Paul is saying the evidence for God's creation is very clear, and they're without excuse. So I like this cartoon from Calvin and Hobbes back in my day. Mom is saying to Calvin, time for your bath, let's go. And Calvin puts up his little puny hand and says, sorry, I'm in denial about baths. And Mom says, fine, plonk, go ahead and deny it. And Calvin says in the last thing, nobody respects my denial, okay? And I laugh at that because evolutionists are in denial about evidence for creation. The evidence for creation is painfully obvious. It's clearly seen. You can see the evidence for creation, both in the big scale and in the small scale. The evidence is there for everybody to see. And I like what the psalmist says in Psalm 111, the works of the Lord are great, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein. His work is honorable and glorious. Yes, His work is honorable and glorious. And as a creation zoologist, when I study God's living creation, that's what I think. When I see these parasite life cycles, yes, they're sophisticated, and parasites would ruin your day given the chance. But when I see some of the other things that are going on in the 70 trillion cells in our body, we look at that as being honorable and glorious. He hath made his wonderful works to be remembered. And it starts with the beginning, doesn't it? In the beginning, Genesis chapter 1, which is the genesis of creation science. God has created after their kind. Here's a theological question for all of you theologians out there. Okay, help me out here. How many times do we see that phrase, after their kind, after its kind, after his kind, taken all together? How many times do we see that phrase in Genesis chapter 1? It's just us here this morning. I'll give you a hint. It's more than three times, it's less than 50. How many times do we see that phrase? The answer is 10 times. 10 times God has told us in one chapter of Genesis, 10 times he has said that he is created after their kind. Now, students, please, listen. We remember what our parents said to us, right? They repeat things to us. They repeated us. You know, this time a decade ago, your mom was saying something, and then she'd repeat it, and then she'd say it again, right? And she'd repeat herself, and she'd be redundant because she wants you to understand. Make your bed. Make your bed. Did you make your bed? Would you please make your bed, okay? And so we remember about that, our parents telling us and being redundant and repeating themselves and being redundant and repeating themselves and being, okay, you get the idea. And so what we see here is God is being redundant and repeating himself, not once or twice, but 10 times. And he used the phrase, after their kind. Why did he do that? Why did God tell us 10 times? I mean, this is chilling for the child of God, because this is something that God wants us to know and to understand. What's he saying? He is telling us, I did not use evolution. That's what he's saying. I did not use evolution, because it says here he created after their kind, okay? There's no reference to evolutionary naturalism here. God created the dog after the dog kind, the cow after the cow kind, the cat after the cat kind, and we can go down the zoological list and understand that God created after their kind. And he told us 10 times. I love puppy dogs. I love them. And back in California, before we came out here a decade ago, we had a Canardly dog. Oh, we loved Maggie the Canardly dog. Have you ever seen those Canardly dogs? You can hardly tell what kind of dog they were. You know, but dogs have always been dogs. Everything from that massive Mexican Chihuahua to that little bitty Great Dane that the ladies carry in their purse and everything. And everything in between, right? Dogs have always been dogs, even those horribly mutated dogs that we call poodles. Sorry. But the point is, dogs have always been dogs, right? So you don't have a cross between a dog and a cat. That'd be a cog or a dat. Okay, dogs have always been dogs. You get an incredible variation of variety, but in the final event, dogs have always been dogs. Same thing with people, right? People have always been people. See how easy science is? Dogs have always been dogs. People have always been people. There is horizontal variation, right? Okay, we run into people that have parents from different ends of the earth, and here they are today. So that's called horizontal variation. We have no problem with that in creation science. There's approximately 13,000 varieties of roses. I'm a zoologist, I study animals, so I'm surprised to see that quote there, but it's true. There are 13,000 varieties of roses. But what are they, class? They're roses, right? They're roses. God has built into the rose genome intense, amazing variation, we believe, for aesthetic value. Yeah, but roses have always been roses. But there's no vertical evolution. Some would call it macroevolution. There is horizontal variation. There's variation within the created kind, if you're taking notes. But there's no vertical evolution, no macroevolution. All of a sudden, folks, we have run into evidence for evolution. Here it is, a cross between a tiger and a lion. They call it a liger. So let's go ahead and close in prayer this morning. Here we find a liger. It's a half-ton kitty cat, 1,100 pounds. Meow! Hey, when that thing lays around the house, it lays around the house. Okay, a half-ton kitty cat. Has the evolutionist got up on their high horse and said, evidence for evolution. Close down that Institute for Creation Research. And you know what? They haven't done that. Why? Because they know as well as us that this is not evidence of evolution. What's this evidence of, class? Help me out. Variation within the created kind, right? It's of the cat kind. That's not evidence of evolution. The evolutionist has been as quiet as a mouse blowing bubbles in a feather bed. They haven't said anything about that because they understand that this is not evidence for evolution. What about this? Okay, this is not Photoshop. Look at Junior. Look at those pairs of socks. Okay. And so we find Junior. This is not Photoshop. Look at those socks. And Mom is standing behind him. Mom is a donkey, and Dad is not in the picture, but he's a what? A zebra. So what are you going to call Junior? Well, let's call him a zonkey. Evidence for evolution? This is not evidence for evolution. This is evidence of what? Variation of the horse kind, isn't it? Evidence of variation of the horse kind. Again, the evolutionists, they've been very quiet about this because they understand this is not evidence of real evolution. Okay, finally, we're going to get into what I'd like to talk about this morning. Let's look at astronomical evidences for creation. We love to look at the heavens. I mentioned earlier, Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God. Let's see what happens here. This was a late Charles Townes. He went to be with the Lord about 2 years ago. He said, as a Nobel Prize winning physicist, somehow intelligence must have been involved in the laws of the universe. This is a conclusion he came to. Remember what Paul said in Romans chapter 1, that God's creation is? Two words, class. Clearly seen. God's creation is clearly seen. Here this, he wasn't an evolutionist, but he looked at the heavens and he said, you know, as a Nobel Prize winning PhD physicist, intelligence must have been involved in the laws of the universe. What he is saying is basically what Paul says in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, God's creation is clearly seen. When he asks, when he makes a statement like this, we would ask the question, is it wrong to go where the evidence leads? If it looks like this universe has been designed with laws from a lawgiver, let's go ahead and investigate that with that idea in mind. How did the planets form? I have to go through this quickly, but planetary formation, class, is very enigmatic, very puzzling for the evolutionist. The evolutionist is basically clueless in this 21st century about how planets form. The discovery of thousands of star systems, wildly different from our own, has, look at that, demolished ideas about how planets form. That's evolutionary ideas about how planets form. In other words, this secular author, secular means non-Christian author, non-biblical author, is taking us back to square one about how the planets formed. She's saying, we now know nothing about planetary formation. That's a good point because planets coming spinning down from a cosmic cloud of debris does not work. The physics is all against that. You've got to bring all that stuff and that material together against the laws of common physics in order to form a planet, and then put that planet in an exquisite orbit around a star so it can survive. And then the same author said, perhaps the biggest question is why our solar system is so different. Our solar system is painfully unique. It's incredibly unique. Our little solar system with all the planets that you had to memorize in junior high is found in one of the arms of the Milky Way galaxy. It's not in the center of the Milky Way galaxy because that has high energy cosmic radiation times 10, not to mention black holes and also other things that would just ruin your day. And so God has placed our little solar system out on the edge of one of the arms of our Milky Way galaxy so that we can look out and not be blinded by cosmic energy and say, how great thou art. Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God. And the evolutionist, I salute this evolutionist who said this, because basically they're saying we just don't know how planets form. If our solar system had been born with more iron, I talked about iron earlier, Jupiter might have kicked Earth into the sun. I hate it when that happens. And so we just have the right concentration of iron in our solar system to maintain the kind of orbital velocities that all of the planets experience. And as the greatest scientist who ever lived, Sir Isaac Newton, who is a dyed-in-the-wool Christian, said that the planets that are they're going through in our solar system require a divine arm, he said, to impress them. A divine arm to impress them. Well, what about our moon? I love the moon. Not only because of the recent, eclipse, with the eclipse, but our moon is exquisitely designed. Everything about our moon is perfect. Not just so, it's perfect. The diameter of the moon, perfect. Its distance from the Earth, perfect. Orbital velocity, perfect. Everything about the moon is perfect. Scientists have even found insects on the moon. This is amazing. The scientists are calling them lunatics. But everything about... I got some reaction there. Good. Okay, make sure you write that down. But the point is this, that everything about the moon is exquisitely designed. So much so that two atheists wrote a book about the moon. Well, big deal, Mr. Sherwin. Yeah, it is a big deal, because they're atheists. They don't believe that in the beginning God created. They have no theological axe to grind. But they wrote these two atheists wrote a book about the moon a couple of years ago. And look at the title of the book that they wrote about the moon as atheists. What built the moon? Oh, no. Who built the moon? They personified it. They asked the question that no evolutionist dare ask. They personified it. They said, somebody must have built the moon. Why? Because of what I said just a minute ago. The moon is exquisitely designed. Everything about the moon, as Goldilocks said, is just right. You got to say it in a higher voice. Just right. Everything about the moon is just right. So these two atheists who have no theological axe to grind are asking the question, who built the moon? That reminds me of a verse in the Bible. It's found in the book of Romans, chapter 1 and verse 20. The Apostle Paul said that God's creation is clearly seen. Do you remember I mentioned that? Clearly seen creation. Here is living proof. Two atheists looking at the moon and saying, somebody had to have built it. I'm going, bing, 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 bing. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. From the big to the small, let's look at some of the animals of God's creation. I'm a zoologist. Finally, we can talk about animals. Here's a frog, and the frog is eating, this is so delicious, the remains of an insect. And so these mean old beetle eaters, like a frog, sneak up behind an innocent insect, put out their long, sticky tongue, and it's lunchtime, a hot lunch. Here's a toad, and he's putting out his tongue to eat a delicious beetle or bug. And think about that, how a frog will come up behind an innocent beetle and put out its tongue, and boom, an explosion at 212 degrees Fahrenheit comes out from the back of the beetle and blasts down the gullet of this poor toad or frog, because that insect, that beetle that the frog tried to eat, was what we call the bombardier beetle. And the bombardier beetle is pretty amazing. Yes, I have held a bombardier beetle in San Diego in my fingers. Isn't that what they call us in Texas, fingers? And I took this beetle in my fingers and got it mad. And of course, you got to get it mad. And I think I told him the check didn't clear or something. And boom, 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 against my fingertip was the beetle. And the beetle has, what you see here in the picture, has an ability. And did you see that silver? I don't have my pointer, but the silver bars that are holding on to one of the legs there, that's a pair of forceps. A pair of forceps or tweezers. And that evil zoologist, and zoologists are basically evil, they were pulling on that leg of that poor beetle. And the beetle is getting mad, as you might imagine, and swinging his rear end around, and boom, 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 an explosion at 212 degrees Fahrenheit against that source of irritation, the tweezers. And so here is a kind of a blown up, no pun intended, portion of the beetle to look at what's going on internally in this bombardier beetle. You have hydroquinone. Well, that's an organic compound. It's what we call in biology a benzene ring. But hydroquinones are very, very toxic. It was formerly what they used to develop film with before the advent of the cell phone camera. But also there's hydroquinone. Look at the concentration of hydroquinone. That's 28%. The hydrogen peroxide 28% in the beetle, but the hydrogen peroxide you get at Walgreens, that's 3%. And you ever taken hydrogen peroxide, 3%, poured it into a cut? Yaha, it burn, right? It hurts, doesn't it? And all the bubbling and fizzing there, you know what those individual bubbles are? Pure oxygen. So as you pour hydrogen peroxide into a cut, now all that bubbling and fizzing, that's pure oxygen being liberated because hydrogen peroxide, the chemical formula, is H2O2. Remember, water is H2O, but H2O2, that's an extra oxygen, which is very reactive and helps to clean out a wound there. But, folks, listen, if you were to take 28% hydrogen peroxide and pour that into a cut or a blemish, it would bubble and fizz your muscle and your tissues and your skin away, and you'd have nice shiny bone. Oh boy, well that's really cleaned it out. Okay, what do they say? Don't try that at home, okay? And you really can't get hydrogen peroxide in that kind of concentration, but here's my point this morning. You would have to bring all of these various portions together inside of an innocent little beetle in order to make this go and make it react. And so you can't leave something out and have this as survival value. They've all, the pieces have to be together functioning perfectly. What's my point about this? The Bible in Genesis talks about fire-breathing dragons, doesn't it? And some people have said, I cannot believe that. No such thing as fire-breathing dragons. And yet we simply point a person to this little innocent bombardier beetle that can ruin the day of his fellow insects if he so chooses, with the kind of biochemical material that he has at his disposal. And so if God can put all of this into a little beetle, do you suppose he could do that into a large creature like a dinosaur, a fire-breathing dragon? We believe basically dragons were dinosaurs. Shake your head like this. Yeah, I think maybe God can do that. And living things clearly look like they were designed, so how do evolutionists know they weren't designed? If you're taking notes, you might want to write that down. Even the evolutionists admit that things look designed, but they say the designer is something called natural selection. And I don't understand that. I'll never understand that because it's too vague, it's too cryptic, it's too subjective. Design means a designer. Creation means a creator. And if things look like they're architecturally made, there might be an architect. Capital A. And so living things clearly look they were designed, so how do evolutionists know they weren't designed? Well, look at this. Now, this is something I taught my students when I was teaching pre-med biology at Pensacola Christian College. This is just part of a much, much, much larger diagram showing the biochemical reactions that occur within our body. Up there in the top left-hand portion, you see a little bit of something called the mitochondria. Do you remember that in high school biology, junior high? You learned about the mighty mitochondria, which is a source of energy. In biology, we call it adenosine triphosphate, ATP. But adenosine triphosphate needs to be phosphorylated by certain enzymes from adenosine diphosphate. And so you get all that going on right here in order to have those high energy bonds that break and release energy that we're using right now. Any subtle movement going on in your body is due to ATP energy that's made in this manner that we see here. This is the famous Krebs cycle. You see that circle there? That's a Krebs cycle. all sorts of sophisticated reactions going on. My students had to write that out for their final exam, a 6-carbon molecule to a 5-carbon molecule and then to 4-carbon molecules coming around, picking up another 2-carbon acetyl group. 2-carbon acetyl group plus another 4-carbon gives you a 6-carbon molecule, and it goes around again. This is happening in your cells, hand over fist. Hundreds of millions of reactions just like this. And it begins with something called glycolysis, where you take in just table sugar, which is two monosaccharides hooked together to give you a disaccharide, and you have a special enzyme that breaks that disaccharide into the two individual monosaccharides, and it goes through glycolysis, glyco meaning a carbohydrate, lysis meaning to break, and then it gives you a very, very energy-rich 3-carbon molecule that goes through something called the pyruvate dehydrogenase system. Now, I'm giving you just a quick thumbnail sketch of that, and the diagrams would be ever so more sophisticated than this. And yet the evolutionist says, how can you seriously believe all this is a result of intelligence? Do you see how silly that is? When you look at a diagram like this, well, it reminds me of a verse in the Bible. It's found in the book of Romans, chapter 1, verse 20, where God says his creation is, what are the two words, class? Clearly seen, right here. We see a clearly seen creation right here. God is not the author of confusion. We can look at this and come to the conclusion that design means a designer and creation means a creator. And yes, I seriously believe this is a result of divine intelligence, as what the Apostle Paul said in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. Well, I'm an invertebrate zoologist. You have to be an invertebrate zoologist in order to be a parasitologist, because parasites are invertebrates. And the way that parasites spread the next generation to the host, the definitive host, is through invertebrates like insects. And so I had a 5-credit-hour course in entomology, which is a study of insects, and I enjoyed that very, very much. A lot of memorization went on there. But these are invertebrates too. They're called jellyfish. There's nothing simple about jellyfish, even though they are 94% water. But it's that critical remaining 6% that makes jellyfish so unique. And I believe, as a creation zoologist, that God created jellyfish as somebody said jellyfish, very good. God created jellyfish as jellyfish, right. And so here we find this quote here that the jellyfish, and they belong to the phylum called Scyphozoa, have always been jellyfish. And the larger group, they goes back 700 million years. Wow. Well, we don't believe that time period for a second, no pun intended, but we believe it was just thousands of years ago, and this planet suffered a worldwide flood about 4,500 years ago. And this worldwide flood called the Genesis Flood, as we read about in Genesis chapter 6 through Genesis chapter 8, explains why we find such well-preserved fossils today. And when you look to the fossil record, we're finding now fossils of jellyfish. Frank, you just told me jellyfish are 94% water. How can you get a jellyfish fossil? And the answer is through something like a catastrophe, a really big catastrophe. It'd have to be waterborne, of course, because these things are found in the water. A waterborne catastrophe that would suddenly and catastrophically bury these jellyfish. What would do something like that? Well, you go back to Genesis chapter 6 or Genesis chapter 8 and read about the worldwide flood and find out that jellyfish have always been jellyfish. You can ignore that 700 million years. That simply didn't happen. This the flood occurred very recently, just thousands of years ago. But look at the quote there from this individual who's not a creationist. The most creative guy in the world couldn't have come up with that. And he's talking about this West Coast sea nettle. It's a very, very sophisticated creature. And the reason why we know that they have existed as jellyfish is looking at the fossil record, they've always been jellyfish. And jellyfish fossils are almost an oxymoron, isn't it? You know, jellyfish fossil, that's kind of like saying airline food. Okay. Or Microsoft Works. All right. This is a crab eater seal teeth, okay? We believe that God created each animal and plant to move in and to fill their particular niche, their environment. Look at the dentition, look at the teeth of the crab eater seal. Exquisitely designed to what? Munch and crunch crabs. And so God has designed the crab eater seal to eat crab using this kind of dentition, which is perfect. Perfect for eating crabs there. We know that the crab eater seal is successful. Why? We still have crab eater seals. If we still have them, obviously they're doing a pretty good job, aren't they? But this asks the bigger question, and that is, have teeth always been teeth? Shake your head like this. Yes, teeth have always been teeth. Here's what one evolutionist said about 7 years ago, and he is no creationist. Look what he said regarding teeth. The details of when, where, why, and how teeth first appeared elude consensus. In other words, they don't know where teeth came from, okay? What do we say as creationists this morning? God created animals complete with their teeth, and that teeth have always been? Teeth, very good, and that's exactly what we find. Teeth are designed by the Creator as teeth. We're out of time now. Let me give you one last example, and then we'll quickly do this. This is a woodpecker. Woodpecker makes their living by bashing their head into a tree. Okay, and the woodpecker gets against the tree there, and then it gets underneath the bark to where all those grubs and insects and ants and, boy, I'm getting hungry, beetles are. And so, unfortunately, the beetles and the insects and the grubs that are underneath the bark that Mr. Woodpecker is trying to get to, they can hear Mr. Woodpecker and they're saying, let's get out of Dodge. Good idea, Larry. And they start getting out, going down those tunnels, those galleries that you see in what we call in biology the vascular cambium, that part of the tree that they like to eat. So they go down these galleries and tunnels and all that. Mr. Woodpecker gets underneath the bark, no insects. Mr. Woodpecker starves to death, and that's why today we have no woodpeckers. Wait a minute, we do have woodpeckers, don't we? What did God do as an infinite wisdom? He gave Mr. Woodpecker an edge. In this case, he gave Mr. Woodpecker a long, long, sticky tongue. And here is a portion of Mr. Woodpecker's long, sticky tongue. It's about half the length of the bird's body. So once it gets underneath the bark, it sends out that long, sticky tongue down the gallery, down the tunnels, and gets those delicious grubs and insects. Did I say that? Beetles and millipedes and all those other, oh boy, delicious. And so the woodpecker is exquisitely designed to use its tongue to get that, and the evolutionist is in a very difficult position to say an ordinary bird hundreds of thousands of years ago must have received the right kind of genetic mistakes that would turn an ordinary bird into a woodpecker. And yet what we find is that the tongue of the woodpecker is designed by the Creator to go around the skull twice and the end of the tongue to go into the right nostril. And here is how it's traced up there. So it's an engineering dilemma for the woodpecker, but God has designed the woodpecker to sling its tongue twice around its skull underneath the feathers, but on top of the skull, and store it there when it's not using it. That's why when you see woodpeckers flying along, it doesn't have its tongue hanging out its beak, you know, the breeze there. I mean, that would be difficult, wouldn't it? And it would just ruin his day, get caught, you know, hang itself by its tongue. What a way to go. And so woodpecker tongues are designed the way that you see there. The birds have a little subdural space between their brains and their skulls, so the brain does not have room to bump around as does in humans. How many boxers, professional and otherwise, suffer brain damage? Answer, 80%. Some say 100%. I kind of gravitate towards that. But definitely 80% of all boxers have brain damage because their brain is not designed to constantly get hit in the head all the time. You know, unless you're a politician, I guess. But the point is that here we find God, in his infinite wisdom, has designed the woodpecker brain and skull so it never gets a headache. Imagine that, a woodpecker with a headache. That's like a millipede with athlete's foot, or a giraffe with a sore throat. But so isn't that amazing? Chaz, we'll go ahead and take some questions now. And remember, as Chaz is coming around with the microphone, we're the Institute for Creation. research. We're not the Institute for Creation Answers. So there's a good chance that you might ask a question that I really don't know too much about, like starlight and time. Can't help you there. I'm a zoologist. But Jazz, go ahead. That is an excellent question. Okay, next question, Chaz? Oh, no. The point is that both are events that occurred in the unobserved past. You know, the evolutionist would be intellectually honest and say, yeah, this happened 700 million years ago. They don't use the word faith, but that's what they're asking us to do, is to have faith that that happened 700 million years ago. And I said, remember, it was unobserved, nobody's there to take notes. With creation, that's not really the case, because we have somebody who was there in the beginning who took notes, if you will. It's called the book of Genesis, and told us what happened. However, you are right, it was a one-time event that occurred in the unobserved past. The key is, they don't have any written record of what happened, but we do. You know, God wants us to read it, understand it, take it by faith, and to tell others about it there. But we cannot redo creation in the laboratory, right? We cannot do the first day of creation. That happened in the unobserved past, and the evolutionist, if they're intellectually honest, would agree that all of what happened in the deep evolutionary time also happened in the unobserved past and cannot be duplicated in the lab. Okay, quick. Fossil record, first of all, remember, the Genesis flood occurred about 4,500 years ago. It was a worldwide event. The Genesis describes about the fountains of the deep bursting forth. That's mentioned first. And then the windows of heaven opening up for 40 days and 40 nights. So those are two sources of water. The average depth of the ocean is 2.5 miles. That's the average depth of the ocean. How much water does the earth cover, is covered on the earth? About 73%. Is there enough water for a worldwide flood? There is more than enough water for a worldwide flood. So if God sent a flood thousands of years ago, it was a catastrophic inundation. When it says that the fountains of the great deep, that implies tectonic activity. Earthquakes and so forth, that would result in a very, very terrifying and catastrophic flood that would bury the plants and animals in what we call the pre-flood world, bury them as we see them today in the various layers of sediment containing all of these fossils. So a fossil is simply the hard and soft parts of an animal or plant that has been preserved by a rapid and catastrophic burial. Here's one thing very quickly. 95% of all fossils, we've seen fossils before, 95% of all fossils are what we call marine invertebrates. Marine invertebrates. For the layman, that would be clams. So 95% of all fossils are clams. Just think clams. Clams, clams, clams. The remaining 5% are all of the vertebrates, animals with a backbone, such as dinosaurs and all, and plants and fish and things like that. But a vast, vast, vast majority are marine invertebrates. Why don't we find any people in the fossil record? Two reasons. One is theological, one is scientific. Why did God send a flood thousands of years ago? Because it says in Genesis that the earth was filled with violence. The sin of mankind, the earth was filled with violence. So when God says judgment upon man, he does a very, very good job. I personally believe that's why we don't find human fossils. There was a scouring effect. God was judging not only his creation that's been corrupted by sin, but man in particular. And so the second thing reason is more scientific reason. As you sit here this morning, what percentage of your body is water? Is around 60%. So really, you're just a bag of water enclosed by skin, about 60, 63% water. Who has more water, men or women? Guys do. So guys, you're pretty wishy-washy. Guys have a little bit more water than ladies do. But my point is, in a catastrophic flood, this inundation, this body of ours wouldn't hold up very well. However, with that said, and I'll be done here, is that we have been finding traces of human bones in layers of rock that they're not supposed to be there, such as the metacarpals of the feet. The Science magazine, which is no creationist publication, has written that up, and I have that in my presentation on human evolution, so-called, where they do admit they have found human bones, not complete skeletons, in layers that they're not supposed to. If you have any questions about that, I'll go ahead and give you the reference. It's Science magazine, it's easy enough. Yes? Yeah, with irreducible complexity, I think a real good example of what we saw was a bombardier beetle, and that all of the functions within that tiny bombardier beetle with the two chemicals, hydrogen peroxide, hydroquinone, they all have to be there functioning and working together in order to do what the bombardier beetle does, and that is blast the oppressor right in the face with a caustic boiling point of water material. And so that's what Michael Behe, the biochemist, who's not a creationist, he is an evolutionist, but Michael Behe coined the term, the phrase, irreducible complexity, and he used the mousetrap as an analogy. And he said, basically, you have to have all the parts of a mousetrap there and functioning and working in order to catch a mouse. And so in my field of parasitology, it's the same thing. I won't have time to give you an example, maybe Ascaris lumbricoides. Ascaris lumbricoides is a large intestinal roundworm. It's ubiquitous. Hundreds of millions of people have ascariasis, which is Ascaris, this roundworm that sometimes you read about. It's a nematode. But all the parts of that have to be functioning and working completely in order to have the infection rate that they have. But it gets into a little bit more zoology. But yeah, irreducible complexity, I use that in my creation explanation, even from an evolutionist like Michael Behe. He makes a very good point. Okay, very good. We don't use the word proof very much in creation science. And if the evolutionists were smart, they wouldn't use the word proof either, because philosophers of science are very, very hesitant to even think that we might even use the word proof. But there is evidence for that. Although, yeah, I'm praying very quickly, and we have to leave. I'm praying that we will find a Tyrannosaurus rex fossil in the fossil record, and in the jaws of the T-Rex is a human fossil. That would be great, but we have something that's just as good as from my standpoint, and that is soft dinosaur tissue. We've all heard of soft dinosaur tissue. I hope you have. They have now, for the past 15 years, have been finding evidence, not evidence, but real soft dinosaur tissue. That's another oxymoron. You know, and this soft dinosaur tissue is pliable, it's stretchy, it's gooey. And what does evolution say? Evolution says that dinosaurs evolved from a non-dinosaur ancestor millions and millions of years ago. They became extinct 66 million years ago. It used to be 65. Now they had a re-evaluation 66 million years ago. Some of these soft tissue finds are 80 million, 100 million years old by evolutionary dating. How can tissue not? This gets into my field class. I'm a zoologist, so I've had histology, which is a study of tissues. I've had that twice. I've had it as an undergraduate. Then I have the study of tissues, histology, as a graduate student. And so I'm here to tell you that soft, pleable, stretchy, beta-pleated sheets of collagen don't remain soft and stretchy for even a half million years, let alone a million years, let alone 80 million years. The timing is way off. And so it's true, we don't find human and dinosaur fossil together, I believe, for environmental reasons. You wouldn't expect people and dinosaurs to live together, so we don't find them buried together due to their separation, ecologically speaking. They did live at the same time, but they were buried in various layers. I'm out of time. Pastor, I'll turn it over to you.